Welcome to Crypto Nights, where we help you finally make sense of the trending world of cryptocurrencies. So gather your virtual piggy bank and let's get started.
Welcome to the next episode of Crypto Nights, where the best minds bridge the crypto divide. I'm your host, Kanth Mariala. I'm really excited to bring these guest speakers. We have two of them today. But before I get there, my usual disclaimer, these audios and podcasts are for educational purposes only, not a solicitation or endorsement for investment. You do so at your sole discretion. We suggest you do your due diligence. We are not financial advisors. Tokens are highly risky. You could lose all of your invested money. Today, it's my honor and privilege to introduce to you our youngest speaker so far, probably about, 19, 20 years of age, Shingo Levine, sophomore at Brown University, Computer Science and Economics. He and his dad, Adam Levine, have co-founded and launched BitQuence, whose mission is to make the daunting world of cryptocurrencies accessible to everybody. They want to accelerate the adoption of blockchain technology and democratize the ownership of cryptos. Awesome stuff. That's really what we want to do. So I'm super excited about that. And BitQuence is an ERC-20 token, successfully raised several million dollars of funding through a token sale, and it acts as a gas on the platform for creating liquidity and growing value for the BitQuence BQX token. And we also take this opportunity to introduce to you our second guest speaker that is on the call today, Stephen Corliss. Talk about at the other end of the spectrum, tremendous amount of background, over 2 to 3 decades of fintech experience, has a tremendous profile on LinkedIn. You can go through that, Stephen Corliss. And he has worked in fintech in many, many different areas, many companies, has a huge broad background in the area. And he brings that wealth of network and connections and background to BitQuence to make sure that the vision of BitQuence can be accomplished. I mean, this is awesome. Shingo may be young, but he and his dad, Adam, have brought together a phenomenal team, of which one of the key players on their team is Stephen Corliss. So without further ado, help me welcome our guest speakers, Stephen and Shingo. Hi, Shingo. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to this podcast. We are very excited to have both of you on this podcast. And I want to start off by, at a top level, starting to discuss what BitQuence is and what are the problems it's trying to address, and then maybe we'll drill down.
Yeah, thanks, Kanth. Thanks for inviting us to this podcast. It's a pleasure to be here. So I think that BitQuence, we can really kind of summarize what we're trying to solve into 4 different problem opportunities. One is what we call the merciless democracy of cryptocurrency. We can dig more into what that means, but you know, cryptocurrency is a democracy, but it's a pretty merciless one if you don't know how to navigate the space. Two, kind of the dizzying array of tokens and coins that are out there, which ones are scams, which ones aren't, how do you classify them, which ones are going to grow in value, which ones are a good store of value, all these, there's a lot of different factors to consider when thinking about all the different tokens that are out there. Three, I think, is a disruption play for BitQuence, and thinking about kind of the existing players in the space. There are a lot of centralized players that exist in the space right now, and kind of a lot of people call Coinbase the new bank. Exchanges, are basically all centralized right now. And then kind of the fourth thing is something kind of closer to me personally. There's a fundamental distrust of financial institutions and financial partners now. Of millennials, only 8% trust their financial institution now. Especially in my generation, there's this kind of distrust from all the financial issues that have been going on in the world. Of these financial partners and, kind of what they do for us. And I think there's a very large willingness to switch to something that works better.
I totally agree with you. I've heard people say that, people who are 12, 13, 14 years of age in 2008 have now grown up to be 20, 22 years of age, and they're not super happy about what they went through. But let's come back to let's drill down each one of these pieces. And I would request you to probably give us an example or a story that made that an important issue. So starting off with the merciless democracy of crypto, that's a very interesting choice of words. I kind of feel that I can sense what you mean by it and I agree with it, but I would like to hear your definition and some examples.
Yeah. Well, kind of, if you think about the way cryptocurrency works, it always operates in the way it's supposed to. And that's, you know, that's the best thing about it is that, you know, it's all cryptography, it's all math. You know, 1 + 1 always equals 2. So, it operates in a way that's fair to everyone. Doesn't care who you are, where you are, or how you're using it. But, with that, if you screw up a little bit, then, you know, your money's gone. You forgot your private key. You lost access to your money. You know, forget one character in an address, or, you know, type in one wrong character, your money's gone. You know, you got phished and went to the wrong site, your money's gone. You could send your coin to the wrong address type, and then all of a sudden your money's gone, and, you know, you bought the wrong coin, or your exchange gets hacked, then, you know, your money's gone. So there's so many ways for, you know, people to lose money. And I think that feeling is sort of a barrier to entry in the market right now, because people are very kind of concerned about, you know, putting their money into this, especially if, you know, your money can disappear off to some cryptographic address, you know, light years away. And kind of what, where this came out of was, when my aunt was trying to, invest in cryptocurrencies. You know, she wanted to invest in Ethereum back when it was very cheap, $7 or so. But she just didn't know how to. She was worried she'd mess up something or rather, and then she wouldn't have any ether, or she would send it somewhere wrong, or, you know, pay the wrong people. So, you know, there's a lot of people who are interested in what's going on in this space and interested in, you know, how do I get into this space, but can't because it's a merciless democracy.
I totally agree with you. It's so funny. And my kids were helping my dad, which is their granddad in their 70s, to learn the iPad. They said, "Grandpa, you won't break anything. Keep trying." You know, unlike that, when you look at this crypto space, you will break. You will lose money. This is like scary, right? And I myself have been a part of that. And I'd also invested in MetaCert. Paul Walsh talks about phishing all the time. And he had in the last just 30 days, processed about 120 million phishing web URLs, out of which thousands and thousands and thousands of them were phishing links. So I totally understand what you mean by the merciless part of it. It's almost like they designed something that is extremely good, but it is not necessarily a great user experience. Far from can be very dangerous. Okay.
Exactly.
So the next thing that you mentioned was ever increasing market of tokens and coins. Somebody was telling me that they're listing about 10 ICOs per day. At this rate, the number of tokens being sold on the exchanges will exceed NASDAQ and NYSE put together in a few months. I guess that's what you're trying to tell us, that there is a overload. But you're also talking about it's difficult to figure out which ones are legit, which ones are not. Can you shed some light on that, please?
Sure. And what we've been working on actually at Bitcoins, we recently released a token classification framework, because it's very, you know, the regulation is very unclear right now exactly who falls where, and even what the regulatory bodies have said thus far. I don't think a lot of people quite understand exactly what they're saying. Steven, do you want to kind of dive a little bit more into that?
Yeah, it's funny. I actually have a slightly different view, right? I think the regulations globally are actually very clear. I think the problem that we have is when you go back to the early days of crypto, there is this bit of a, you know, cavalier kind of view of regulations and things like that. And I think that is coming back to really bite some folks hard, right? And so really, it's not really that difficult, right? But I think what everyone is doing or has done, and actually is still continuing to do, is to just kind of look at something that was done previously, model that, and move forward, right? But that, to take such an approach, that means, you know, first of all, it's very risky, but that for that to work, you have to be modeling it off of a peer or, you know, an earlier company that got it right, right? So that's the big issue here, right? So we've got it. We've got a lot of folks rushing out to, you know, to get to their token sale and list on every exchange that they can get on without really stopping and pausing and thinking about, well, what do I really have here? What am I really offering, right? What are the rights that I'm giving my users? Are they users or are they investors, right? So I'll kind of, without, I could go on for days about this part, but I'll kind of, where I'll leave it is this, is that, you know, what we're doing is because we believe the rules are clearer, at least from our perspective, what we're doing is looking at the entire landscape and, you know, running every token through, or at least, you know, beginning with the top couple of 200, running them through our framework to really validate what they are, right? Is this a utility or functional token? Yes or no? If it's not, then what is it? Right? Is it a tokenized security? So being able to classify something into those two high level buckets is absolutely critical, not only to businesses and platforms like ours, right? Because, you know, if you touch a tokenized security, then you need to be a regulated entity to do so, right? So you need to be very cognizant of that. Yeah. But, you know, all of this is actually very important to investors, right? So if I bought into a token sale for a tokenized security that didn't get approval from a local regulator to issue a security, now I have a big problem where, you know, that coin could actually be facing some serious, serious fines and even, you know, censure, which could be a major disruption to both customers of that firm, but also their backers.
So this token classification is going to be extremely useful for somebody like me who has probably seen more of the hype, more of the what they want me to see video type of a thing. And I don't have the time or the patience or the knowledge probably to go through the white paper and dig into the depth and figure out, does this pass the Howey test or not? Is it a security disguise or is it a functional token? So what you are doing is a major service to somebody like me that kind of says, you know, here is a green light, here is a red light, or an amber light, some kind of a classification scheme that tells me, I understand that Bitcoins is not a government body, it's not a regulatory body, but they just used some common sense methods and this is what their take is. So is that kind of where you guys are heading approximately?
Yeah. And I think it's just making the space more accessible and understood. And so you know what you're actually buying. And I can tell you, I don't want to say any names here, but there are some, you know, big coins out there which are classified as tokenized securities. And
on some very big exchanges at the moment, right?
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's dangerous both for consumers, you know, because if they view themselves as an investor in these, you know, tokenized securities, then they could potentially lose a lot of money when they start to get regulated, fined, you know, censure, all those things. And to the exchanges that are trading them, because these exchanges often don't have the proper licenses to handle securities. So it's a very dangerous situation right now. And what we want to avoid is a situation where the government feels like they have to come in and really kind of hammer down with regulation on the space. Because regulation can be a very good thing if we work with the regulators and come up with regulation that makes sense for the industry. Whereas, you know, what we saw with basically the BitLicense in New York, you know, we saw regulation that was unhealthy to the industry and was barring, you know, innovation from happening in the space. So that's kind of a very important issue kind of from a high level, because, you know, when bad actors come into the space and do things that aren't, you know, that you're not supposed to do, that reflects badly on the entire industry. So it's, you know, putting, you know, being able to put those people in the right buckets, being able to frame the industry in a way that's friendly and open to consumers and regulators is something that is really important to us, Bitcoins.
And we have seen that happen in China, for example, where even the companies that raised money were forced to return the money back to the investors. And after several months, I don't know how they did that, but so I mean, I'm not saying that we live in a place which is as draconic, but at the same time, the risk is real that there might be a regulation that kind of goes back in time and penalizes some of these that are obviously securities, right?
Right.
So, okay, I think the point is well made. If nothing, it serves as a warning to people, you know, to look before you leap type of a scenario. I'll move on to the third one, which is contradiction in terms for me, because to me, crypto is all about decentralization, crowdsourcing, crowdfunding, and all of that. But you talk about centralized core players. So, so can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of the players right now are centralized. And I think that's just due to the fact that it's easier to centralize than to decentralize. You know, something very key in Bitcoins that I've been pushing for is having a decentralized universal wallet where, you know, the users have control of the keys. And there's two reasons for that. One is I believe that's actually, you know, beneficial to the user. You know, we don't want to lock up funds. We don't want to, you know, control their funds. We don't want to do all that. And two, because we actually don't want to be custodian of your funds. You know, we don't want to actually be your funds. We don't want, you know, we want to be entirely user directed. Our user has all the control. And if we do it that way, we can actually offer them additional capabilities, since we can say, you know, you can store any coin you want in your wallet, whether it be a tokenized security, a functional token, cryptocurrency. You know, because you control it, and we're not going to allow you to trade it on our platform. We can let you, you know, have complete control of your wallet, and you get to choose what you are buying and depositing into this universal wallet. Because we do want it to be a truly universal wallet, but again, you know, decentralized and user control. And what we see right now in the industry, you know, with players like Coinbase, where Coinbase is basically taking Bitcoin and turning it into a bank. While that, you know, that has value in the short term, I think in the long term, that business model just will not work. And Coinbase is basically using the regulation to its favor in getting a bunch of, you know, all these amalgamous pile of licenses. And basically their position, what they want the position to be, is unless you have all these licenses, you can't operate in the space the way we do. And that gives them a monopoly over the space because there's a huge barrier to entry, which is why, you know, so many people say that Coinbase's value is entirely in its licenses, not in anything else. People don't say Coinbase has great customer service. They don't say, oh, I love the, you know, transaction fees on Coinbase. Nobody says stuff like that, but everyone uses them anyway, and everyone knows about them because they're the only way to turn your fiat into crypto. So kind of that's what we mean by centralized core players, and I think there's a big opportunity for someone to come in and disrupt that current way of thinking in the industry.
Yeah, and I'd expand on that just a little bit, right? So, you know, I like to look at some of the core exchangers, not necessarily your Coinbases of the world, right? Now, there's a lot of folks claiming out there that they're operating peer-to-peer exchanges, right? Now, when I look at several of them, what I see is actually something very different, right? What I see is a company that is really acting as a principal, making markets for, you know, tokens, really, you know, in a centralized manner, right? And now, what a lot of people probably don't understand is that, especially if you're an exchanger in the US, for instance, right? Unless you have an MSB license, or, you know, so you can be involved in money transmission, right? Unless you have that, you really can't operate kind of an exchange as the way we all think about and define what an exchange is, right? So what a lot of these exchanges are doing is actually, although they're putting their vision out there as a peer-to-peer kind of decentralized exchange, you know, in a sense, they're really the exact opposite, right? Because they're trying not to be captured into the money transmission rules, right? What they're doing is saying, I am actually a principal to every trade that a peer or user is doing, right? And what that allows you to do is to really avoid that money transmission classification. But it really kind of goes against the vision that you're kind of portraying out in the public, right? So I think that's a big issue for me anyways, right? Is that if you're going to say you're peer-to-peer, then you should be peer-to-peer, right? If it's P2B, then let's be honest about it, right? So, but let's also understand why we're setting up those models. If you're doing it just to avoid regulation and getting licenses, I don't know if that's necessarily a good enough idea, a good enough reason to do that, right? And that's really, to be honest, how regulators look at it. It's, are you doing something just to avoid rules, or are you doing it for a legitimate reason, right? So now there's a fine line, right, kind of separating those two things. But, again, kind of for me, if there's marketing saying I'm a peer-to-peer exchange and all of those things, then really that's what you should be. You shouldn't be something that's actually quite different, right? Because, from our perspective, if you're a user, really you have now centralized your risk, right, with one entity, right? And that entity is actually known. You just don't really know who it is. You think there's actually a peer on the other side, but there's not. So.
And we have seen those centralized entities being hacked, wallets being millions and millions of dollars worth of cryptos being stolen and all of that.
Yeah.
So it is, that's why I said it's a contradiction in terms. So here I am all excited about this decentralized world. And how do I get in again? Oh, through the centralized architecture.
Right.
And all the bureaucracy that we are trying to avoid and all the high fees that, 1.5%, for heaven's sake, what are you really doing for me to pay that, right?
Let me give you an example of something that Shingo mentioned, right? So when we think about the decentralized universal wallet, right? Let me draw you a kind of a real world correlation, right? So today, if we have some investments, let's say those investments are sitting at Fidelity or Charles Schwab or something like that, right? So in effect, Fidelity and Charles Schwab are your custodian, right? Now, why would someone be in that business, right? They're clearly in that business to make money, okay?
Yeah.
And they're not necessarily just making money off of fees, trading fees or whatever it may be, right? So how are they really making money? And it really comes down to your assets, right? Your assets have other value in the world other than just, price appreciation, right? So, and that, when you think about the size and scale of the structured finance market itself, it is absolutely enormous, right? And so let me give you an example. So if you own Facebook stock and it sits at Fidelity, what is Fidelity doing with that? They're actually leveraging your Facebook stock and loaning that out to hedge funds who are borrowing it, right, because they have a short position. Or they're doing some sort of securitized financing where maybe it's a repo, right? You can actually repo stocks these days as well. Need to be kind of your double A's and all. But my point being that is that your assets actually can generate additional yield for you. But today, because of that over-intermediated model, you actually give up that right to earn that in most circumstances. There's some who give you some sort of profit share, right? But in this example, what we do with a decentralized universal wallet is you are now your own custodian, right? So if your assets have additional value, then there will be opportunities for you to generate that additional interest, right? Because you are retaining the ownership of your assets. I think that is such an important and powerful point, right? And there will be, whether it's our, platforms like ours or other service providers focused on just, structured finance, right? I think the business opportunities are plenty when you think about self-custody and decentralized universe, decentralized wallets. So I'm excited about that piece.
Oh, I am so excited about that. I cannot even begin to tell you how excited, because we have seen these large banks. Everybody knows they have not worked. Every decade or two, we have to bail them out with the taxpayers' money. And you're wondering, you're scratching your head and saying, we've come to the worst of possible worlds where profits are privatized and losses are socialized. And we just, I think we have an opportunity here to do some good and say, hey, we're going to privatize profits and losses, and I'm going to be the owner of both.
Right.
Yeah, I think, and there's like a lot of other companies, you know, trying to build services kind of on top of that idea, you know, peer-to-peer lending networks, you know, decentralized insurance networks, and, you know, decentralized ad exchanges, and all these different kind of ideas. But to me, I think it's a little early to try and do that, because really no one's kind of built the bedrock foundation. That's actually what we're calling our kind of API structure, bedrock. Because it feels just so fundamental to us to build that baseline for the ecosystem, and allow people to actually build this ecosystem that people are dreaming up right now on top of, you know, a set of services that we hope to provide.
Yeah. And let's get on to the, I'm sure we can keep talking about each of these points in the interest of time. Millennials crave new financial partners. First of all, I want you to what everybody might know what millennial, who millennials are. Can you define that, and then you know, give us supporting examples, please?
Well, personally, I don't particularly like the word millennial because it's very vague. We use that word because, you know, people tend to sort of kind of know what it means. You know, people in their, you know, 18 to 25, maybe 30, early 30s. You know, those are usually the people you call millennials. Now people are calling it Generation X, Generation Y, Generation Z. And, you know, it's people finding ways to classify other people. But kind of what we mean is that young people right now really distrust the financial industry kind of as a whole. And they don't trust the banks. They don't trust, you know, financial institutions as much as they used to. And, you know, they do see, you know, they really take to heart the problems that the financial institutions have caused. And I think it didn't have to be this way. You know, if the financial institutions, you know, operated nicely, and they operated in a way that was actually, you know, consumer friendly and consumer facing, you know, we wouldn't have gotten to this point, and maybe we wouldn't have Bitcoin. But the thing is, it's fundamentally a conflict of interest in your banks. And this is something that Stevens really brought up a lot too, which is that, you know, the banks, you know, they're operating services to consumers, but when in reality, their real obligation is to their shareholders, and they have a fiduciary obligation to their shareholders to show a profit and all that. So there really is a big problem right now in the financial industry. And I feel it myself. You know, I don't particularly trust financial institutions, you know, as much as my grandmother does. I'm worried that, you know, something like 2008 could happen again. If we don't change the world, then it doesn't change. That's really what I mean by millennials craving new financial partners, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think I'd kind of, let me play the role of the kind of older generation here.
I was waiting to see what you would say, Stephen, yeah, because I'm myself looking for a word for myself.
So I would actually, I'd probably, you know, say, or use Shingo's example about his grandmother. I'd say it slightly different, right? I don't necessarily believe that we older generation trust the financial industry. I just believe there isn't a choice, right? And what we do trust is that the government is going to build them out, right? To be there to protect my assets. Now, that opens up a whole other conversation, which we won't do here, right? But I think that's the issue. But that's also our opportunity, right? So I believe that not, you know, 90%, 95% of the world population, they actually want something better. They want something different. But unfortunately, there just isn't an option, right? And I think this is what crypto is, right? Is that, and this is really what, you know, what Bitcoin is. This is what we want to do. I think we really want to you know, develop that new model, right? That can be in, that can and will be embraced by, I hate to use the term, millennials and all those older folks, right? So, and I think that's achievable, right? But I go back to something we said earlier. It's all, you know, what drives trust is transparency, safety, and security, right? As long as a consumer knows that you're being transparent and honest, but at the same time that you're, you know, whatever you're doing for them is safe and secure, usually that will give you trust, right? Or lead to trust. But unfortunately, you know, whether it's, you know, big kind of non-crypto companies making, you know, constant mistakes, or even some of our own peers making mistakes, these are the headwinds, right? So what you build needs to be very conscious of all of these things, right? If you do it right, it's going to be powerful. That's for sure.
So I think we have kind of defined the problem, but they are fairly big problems. So why do you believe Bitcoins can solve this problem when many other major players have not been able to? And beyond belief, what is your vision of, what are your solution elements to tackle these? I know we are not saying that, hey, banks will disappear tomorrow, or we will stop using the fiat currencies tomorrow. It's like, I kind of use this as an analogy. We kind of saw the writing on the wall 2 decades back when Amazon came to the fore. People could see that, okay, I'll probably never buy a book in a bookstore again. Borders will go out of business and probably Barnes & Nobles, and then Circuit City, Best Buy, and so on and so forth. But it didn't happen overnight, right? The disruption was clearly beginning, but it took several years. And now we are 20 years into the game. As much as JCPenney's, Macy's, and others are refusing to accept, you can see that market caps have declined in the last 10, 15 years from 40 billion to 2 to 4 billion.
Yeah.
And they're all are teetering on the brinks of bankruptcy. And retail industry has been decimated. And you're seeing the big powerhouse Amazon has just taken over. It's $400 billion in market cap. So I kind of use that analogy to say the writing is on the wall. Here is a definite, it's an irreversible change, no matter who accepts it and who denies it. But it will not happen overnight, because if anything, this will be even harder to dislodge, because these people are not going to give up so easily. These are the same people that took $500 billion from you and me from the tax money and all of that. So they have strong power, and both the banks and the government are on one side, so to speak. I hate to say that, but I like to think that we are all people, but that's not necessarily how things work.
So, I think most, I'm going to let Shingo take most of that, but let me just make this one point. I believe the government's actually in the middle, right? But in their main interest besides consumer protection is systemic risk, right? So, because we've had, you know, this capital market system globally working for how long, right? For an extremely long time. So there's a lot of built-in dependencies, right? That is kind of structured into our existing capital market system. So I think from a regulator standpoint or government standpoint, you need to be cognizant of that while also remaining cognizant about consumers and consumer protection. But they also see the innovation here, right? And what this can do to national economies, the growth that we can add to GDP and all of that. So I think that's why I believe governments are in the middle, and I'll just kind of stop there, but yeah.
Yeah. And also another clarification, I think, is that I think a lot of people think of Bitcoin as competing with the dollar, when I think that's actually not quite accurate. I think that Bitcoin and all these cryptocurrencies are actually competing with banks. And the reason I say that is because I think the dollar is not going to ever just disappear. And I think that's also the government's biggest fear, is that, you know, that the dollar will disappear. So they're going to do everything they can to make sure the dollar doesn't disappear and that it remains the world reserve currency. And I think what will happen to the dollar is that eventually, you know, we'll see a bunch of crypto fiat funds. And, you know, there'll be a government issued dollar that you trade on the blockchain. And that to me seems like a very, you know, good place to go, because then that forces the government to be transparent, you know, and you can see, you know, what the supply of the dollar is. You can see how many new dollars they're minting. But again, I don't see that cryptocurrencies ever, you know, like taking out the dollar. Now on the bank side, again, to Stephen's point, I don't think the governments and the banks, you know, the government isn't systemically tied to the banks in any way besides, I think, you know, lobbying and, you know, the flow of money and those sorts of issues. But there's no reason that they have to be fundamentally tied to the banks. You know, anyone could go in and lobby them, you know, Coinbase could go in and lobby them. And I don't think that there's any real like systemic reason why they would continue to support the banks, especially if they represent systemic risk, and especially if they represent, you know, liability, and especially if they represent, you know, something that's not protecting consumers. And if there's another solution that works better out there, that's cheaper, you know, that has more trust and, you know, has real market adoption and it's innovating the way that finance works, I see no reason that a government wouldn't jump on board on that. And that's really what we want to do. That's really what we want to do with Bitcoins, is, you know, go to the regulators, be friends with the regulators, and help them develop the correct regulation that makes sense for the industry, and help them build a, you know, structure around innovation that makes sense, so that we can build this dream that people are, you know, thinking about right now, decentralizing the way that, you know, we transmit money.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll leave it at that, and just say that, you know, it's really being cognizant of actually who you're trying to change and who you're trying to disrupt. And it's really the intermediaries that we're trying to disrupt, not the governments.
Good, excellent point. And your point about dollars is also correct, because I don't see any. Bitcoin is not behaving like a currency right now. Its killer app is speculation, as somebody said. So
right.
I will leave it at that. But coming back to the more interesting and exciting question about Bitcoins is, why and how do you plan to address those four major challenges, and then get into your actual solutions, product rollout? Which ones have you already rolled out? Which ones are coming down the pike? Just so that, you know, these are major problems. People want solutions, so they want to know when they're going to come out. So I'm eager to know that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think the two main things that we're trying to tackle right now are information and wallet. And I think that wallet, if built correctly, can be kind of, again, the bedrock for a very powerful ecosystem that gets built around this. You know, think about a merchant who wants to accept payments. Think about, you know, someone who just wants to store currencies. Think about someone who wants to start a hedge fund. Think about someone who wants to do an ICO. Think about someone, you know, anyone who wants to interact with cryptocurrencies, you're going to need a wallet. And if we build this wallet in a way that's scalable, decentralized, and accessible, that to me is something already very powerful. And the first release that we are in, probably going to move into beta shortly, is Amber, which is predictions. And we are tying in this prediction data, you know, letting people predict and on these assets into these coin profiles, so that we can make this information more accessible. And I mean, CoinMarketCap is one of the most visited sites on the internet now, more views than the Wall Street Journal. And you know, and all they do is show historical data, and they don't really show much in the way of, you know, the different technologies that these coins are using, you know, what these coins are trying to do, you know, who's behind these coins. So I think what we're trying to do is kind of aggregate all that information to one place that's easy to digest, so you know what you're interacting with, giving people a little taste of the future through this predictions stuff, and then building a wallet that makes all this information accessible and lets you kind of build the foundation for an ecosystem. And then we have more plans to expand from there. We want to integrate fiat later, and then we want to be able to let people diversify. But these are product rollouts that are going to be coming later. So that's really why we chose to do kind of those, the wallet and the information first. And to me, that solves the problem of, you know, the ever increasing market of tokens and coins. We already have our classification framework, so we're classifying all these tokens that we're going to be in the platform. And also it helps solve the merciless democracy of cryptocurrency, you know, making it easier to just interact with your cryptocurrencies, making this universal wallet. You know, you have a little address book so you can make sure you don't send to the wrong place. And I think that we're already trying to tackle these kind of problems one by one. And again, these are massive, massive problems. And there's a reason why, you know, a lot of people have tried and haven't quite solved these problems yet. But we're hoping that our solution will.
Yeah. So, and I'll expand on that a little bit, Conf, right? So when I think about what Shingo just said, right? And this is not a term we've kind of latched onto, right? But really, what are we talking about? We're talking about really a smart wallet, right? Yeah. So when you, and this is kind of the way much of the reason why we structured the rollout the way that we did, right? When I think about predictions, I believe that is feeding an intelligence hub, right? And that intelligence hub has many uses, you know, both within a wallet and then for the things that happen outside of that wallet, right? Whether it's investing, whatever it may be, right? So when I think about the combination of the prediction or intelligence hub kind of feeding the universal wallet, now you have this intelligent wallet, right? That is going to be extremely powerful. While it's also kind of tackling the most, you know, the largest obstacle in crypto, which is really that, you know, getting over that understanding of what, you know, of how to do these things, right? So by simplifying crypto along with, you know, giving people data to make the, you know, to help them make smarter decisions, now that's very interesting to me, because there's a lot of use cases once you have that infrastructure.
Yeah, because I understand the wallet, the fact that you're making it universal, it gives you an ability to handle a lot of things and it's all decentralization. Yeah, but I'm not able to immediately see why the prediction is so important. How do you see that? Can you explain what that is with an example and tell us how that can solve one of these four major issues that you outlined?
Could you repeat the question a little bit? Sorry.
You say that one of the technology elements you're rolling out is this prediction element.
Mm-hmm.
And did I get the name right? Did you call it Amber?
Yes, because okay. Amber gives you, you're looking into the past and thinking about the future.
Yeah. So some kind of a warning as well in some shape or form. So what do you, can you elaborate that? And why, I'm still trying to figure out why you would consider that as an important element to be rolled out in the beginning.
Right. And I think that that's all about data for us and building up a base of data. And because a lot of people in this market right now, kind of our core users, are really data junkies, and they love to see different, you know, slicing this data up into different ways. You know, we've received, you know, tons and tons of requests for people to add technical analysis charts on our platform, which we may have in the future. But I think the fundamental reason behind that is we want experienced users to be helping newer users. You know, that's, you know, a high level vision that we want to be able to enable. And that's why we have this follow feature. We have some basic social functionality in the platform because we want, you know, the experts to be rewarded for helping newer users navigate the space. And again, that goes to the second problem, the ever-increasing market of tokens and coins. You know, you see a coin, it looks good, you know, the tech seems okay, well, then the community is saying, don't buy this, don't buy this. And there may be some reason that they say, don't buy this. Maybe some, you know, the team isn't great, or maybe it's, you know, it's actually a tokenized security. You never know. And, you know, having this base of knowledge that you can query and pull off of, that seems like something important that people would value. And plus it's data that we can then kind of broadcast out and monetize just on our end.
So can you give me an example of a prediction?
Sure. So we have, you know, we'll have, you know, maybe a weekly contest on the price of Bitcoin. And some people are saying, yeah, I think it's going to go to 5,000. Some people are saying, I think it's going to go back down to 4,000. We'll aggregate all these, build a trend line out of it, and then, you know, have a market sentiment on Bitcoin over the next week. And you can see, oh, the sentiment of the community right now is it's going to go up 1.5%. And here's the trend line, here's the current price. And then you can also track against the actual price of what actually happened. And then you can see how accurate the community is, and then you can see how accurate individuals are. And then we have a reputation system in the platform too. So as you're more accurate, we're hoping that you'll have more weight and more sway in the prediction system. And then again, this is all about, you know, having people build expertise so they can share it with others. We anticipate, you know, some features down the line being, you know, being able to peek into someone's basket. You can pay a little bit to that person to peek in their basket, see what the coins they're holding. And you know, the reason you do that is because, you know, maybe they have a very large reputation in the prediction system. They have, you know, historically had a lot of returns, have a lot of followers, so you can see what they're doing, and maybe that's useful to you. And especially, you know, someone newer to the industry, you know, they'll say, oh, I know how to, you know, I know how to buy Bitcoin. Ethereum looks interesting too. Maybe I'll buy some of that, but then, holy crap, there's, you know, 500 other coins out there. What do I do?
Right.
And it's, you know, helping them navigate that process.
And the fact that, you know, a lot of these coins can move 20% in, you know, a few minutes. So, right. I mean, you think about the traditional space. I think people panic about, you know, 1% on a daily basis. Now you're talking about much larger numbers that, you know, could have much larger capital tied to it. So, you know, those things will set you in a panic, right?
And that's what the moments are not. I mean, you're talking about something is 0.0008 cents, and it moved to 0.08 cents, and that's saying that's 100 times. That's beyond volatility. So, and many of them do move that way. Okay, so I think it's a lot about data. And prediction is more about people trying to get a handle on the trends. And you also talked about, I read somewhere that you have this one-click investing. I don't know if that is something that's coming down the pike.
One-click diversification.
One-click diversification. Thank you. Yeah. Does that somehow fit into this? Can I say that, hey, based on the current market sentiment or the community predictions, you know, can I do a one-click diversification of the top 100 cryptos that they're supporting in a certain percentage? I don't know. Maybe I'm misinterpreting what you meant by that, but that's my fanciful interpretation. So how close am I?
One of many use cases, but go ahead, Shingo, okay. Please.
Well, yeah. And I mean, we are thinking about the, you know, different ways to structure the settlement layer. We think we have a very cool solution right now, but we don't want to discuss it yet, but that'll be something exciting to talk about later. The way that we're decentralizing, you know, all the other parts of this.
And can you elaborate? I know you did mention that Bedrock is the name of your API. Can you elaborate a little bit on that, and who is it useful for? Because that sounds exciting. I mean, it looks like something that not just individuals but companies might be interested in. Is that public, or is it going to be released sometime in the near future?
We want to release a public API as we release these products, because I think that's, you know, taking a page from Stripe. You know, the reason Stripe is so successful is basically their entire model is their API. You know, they're a multi-billion-dollar company off of this API, and their API is very simple, easy to use, and everyone uses it to, you know, do a credit card payment. And I think the same you know, the same kind of analogy can be made for all the different ways that you can interact with crypto. You know, it's a pain to have to download an app and then, you know, use that app's APIs for, you know, some number of tokens. Or if you want to integrate fiat, you have to go to Coinbase's API. Or if you want to exchange, you have to go to Bittrex's API. You know, there's just this huge set of APIs out there that aren't particularly scalable in terms of when you want to build an ecosystem on top of this, and are, you know, can be difficult to interface with and just distributed all over the place. And what we want to do is basically build something that allows people to build, you know, buildings on top of this, you know, build the foundation for something great revolution to come. And I think that part of that is, you know, building the correct set of APIs, the correct way of interfacing with all these APIs. And I'm purposely trying to be a little bit vague here, but we have a lot of plans on, you know, making this accessible to both users and companies, and building the strategic partnerships to allow these people and companies to do things that I think won't be possible without this set of APIs.
I totally agree. And yeah, I was surprised when you picked Stripe as an analogy. I thought you would pick Apple's App Store as an analogy or something like that. But I'm imagining that you will, to me, more and more, you sound like a platform, because it's almost impossible for Apple to have built the 500 million apps or something like that. So I'm seeing the same thing going on here. I'm saying you're building some of the fundamental building blocks, Lego blocks, if you will, that have infinite ways of being, or a combinatorially very large way of assembling. So you're kind of giving people an opportunity to assemble them in interesting ways to provide additional value. So again, like you said, you may not be able to talk about all of those right now, but right. But very, very exciting. All that I can say is extremely exciting future. Can you kind of summarize, for the sake of listeners who might not know about Bitquins, what can they already do if they go to your website today? What are the products? Can you kind of direct them, navigate them, and say, hey, if you were the first time visitor to Bitquins, I would recommend you start here and here. And then in the next 1 or 2 months, look out for this, you know, and then sign on to this newsletter to keep up, you know, updated with our progress. Can you kind of give your fans, followers, and first timers a navigation, please?
Well, we're very early stage, so we're right now in the alpha, and we have a product council that is testing the predictions features, you know, and giving us feedback on our coin profiles, and you know, and we're starting to kind of let them play around with what we're thinking for the universal wallet. And we're thinking about moving into beta soon, you know, expanding that out a little bit, because we've been just getting a lot of interest into people who just want to, you know, see what we're working on. And I think our first major release is going to be the Universal Wallet. And we're hoping to get the Universal Wallet out, you know, Q1 next year. And I think that's going to be something to watch out for. And that's something that we're hoping to make a big splash with. And then also we plan to have kind of a mobile and desktop experience concurrently developed on that. So I would say look out for that. But, you know, right now you'll have to just stay tuned on our development.
That's right.
And we can do that by, you have a email way of keeping in touch, or what is the best way to keep in touch with your progress for somebody?
You can come join our Telegram channel. You know, you go to our website and you can scroll down to the bottom and join our Telegram channel. You can join our mailing list, or you can come join our Slack, where we also have a Rocket Chat. You can follow us on Twitter. You can follow us on Facebook. You know, we're everywhere.
Yeah, I would say for anyone who's new to Bitquins, just definitely begin by going to bitquins.com. And I would actually spend some time looking at our inventory of information. I think that'll give your listeners a very good understanding about what this company is all about. And I actually believe the team itself, the vision, the mission, what kind of drives us, all of those things to me matter, right? And I think you'll get a very good sense about really what we're about, and why the team is kind of that unique, perfect team that kind of all have come together, right? Because it's interesting. If we go back to our earlier conversation about millennials and kind of our older crowd, right? Our team is exactly that, a good blend of both, which I think, and Shingo, I think that was very smart, right? I think because if you're trying to deliver mass adoption, I think you have to understand kind of both issues, right? So that part is very, very important. So I would say definitely spend some time on the site. It's not too busy. It's fairly easy to kind of navigate through. And definitely spend your time doing the due diligence on us to make sure that you understand what we're about and you buy into it.
Wow, this is awesome. And the uniqueness about Crypto Nights podcast is we have a relationship with our guest speakers. We already had people like Paul Walsh and Mohit come back multiple times because they had rapid updates and so on and so forth. We plan to do the same with Icon, Menkem. We were actually supposed to interview him after his pre-sale, hoping that there will be a sale, but pre-sale was $45 million in 8 hours, so it ended.
So he
said he's going to come back with updates on the product releases. So I'm hoping that we can do the same with you. We wish you all the best. I mean, you guys are doing an incredible job. I think a lot of people are rooting for you and your team, and I'm one of them, a fan and a follower, but also grateful that you've both found time to talk. But I'm hoping to come back to you guys and follow the success story of Bitquants. Is there any other parting thoughts from either of you before we end the podcast, or you pretty much said what you needed to?
No, and thanks for having us on this podcast. And I think it'll be exciting to come back in a few months or 6 months later and just talk about, all the progress we've made and how, where we see ourselves going from here. Because it's going to be interesting the way that the markets move and the way that we move with it. People say that the crypto market moves 7 times faster than the stock market. So, 6 months is 42 months in the real world.
That's right.
And it's open 24/7.
That's right. So, Kanthan, I would kind of just leave you with this, is that what I'm actually very excited to see is the industry's response when we start to reveal not only our product releases, but our model, right? So I think it's going to get both kind of your traditional financial companies' attention, but also our peers in this industry. So I'm excited about that. And I'm very interested to kind of watch and observe to see how people react.
Oh, and each one of them, I mean, when I look at companies out there and look at your ambition, each one of your elements is like equal to 3 or 4 of the cryptos that are coming out. I mean, just look at decentralized universal wallet. I'm saying, whoa, that's more than a company. That's, each one of these can be a big impact. And again, thank you for your time and wish you all the best. And it's been wonderful chatting with both of you. We'll be back soon.
Yep. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the Crypto Nights. Never miss an episode. Subscribe now at www.cryptonights.io.